So to begin with, my hot topic will be presented as a brief overview of socialism and Catholic objections to socialism. As to why I've chosen it, it's in a way as a topic rather close to my heart, in a weird sort of way, because it's something I've frequently encountered in university. There's a lot of young want-to-be socialists among the youth of today, and it's something I've probably discussed even more than abortion or other similar issues. So to begin with, I suppose we should start with some definitions. So from the Encyclopedia Britannica, the definition I found is that socialism is an economic doctrine wherein society owns and controls the means of production. So since people in society work together, we don't work alone, we're social animals. So as a result, anything one person builds is built with help from those around them. And socialism believes then that since everything is made through a communal effort, everything should be owned and shared by the community.
Sorry, society or the state?
Society, as in everyone within society. You can say the state, but you would have to understand it as everyone. So for the example of Ireland, it would be all 4 million plus people in Ireland would collectively own and control the means of production. I then drew on a definition from Professor Edward Faeser, a Thomist philosopher in California, and he defines socialism as the state or the government, I'll use the two interchangeably here, as owning and controlling the means of production of a basic good. And it's important to understand the concept of basic goods. A basic good is something that can be used to produce many other things. So my bottle here isn't really a basic good. It can't be turned into anything else or used for anything else. I can put water in it, and that's about all it can be used for. Plastic, on the other hand, though, is a basic good, because once plastic is manufactured, it can be used to manufacture everything from boats to aircraft parts to lunch boxes and many things in between. So that's a basic good, and the state then will control the manufacture of these basic goods. So plastic, steel, wood, and other similar goods. Now, it may appear at first sight that these two definitions, so Encyclopedia Britannica's of society controlling the means of production and Dr. Faeser's definition of the government controlling the means of production, are contradictory. They are not. And to understand why they're not, we have to take a little dive into the concept of ownership. So Dr. Faeser defines ownership as being akin to having a set of rights over something. So if I have a book in front of me, my ownership means I have the right to read this book. I have the right to put my name on the inside page so people will know it's mine. I have the right to share it with who I want. I have the right to highlight texts in the book. And I have the right to refuse to lend it to others, as well as the right to dog-ear the pages if I so choose. Now, if a figure of authority steps in, they can tell me, no, you can't dog-ear the top right corner, you have to dog-ear the bottom left corner. You have to share it with this person from 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock in the morning, and you're not allowed to highlight the pages. So by doing that, they have removed some of the rights from me and taken those rights onto themselves. So the practical result or the effective result of this is that they are now a co-owner of the book because they possess some of the rights over the book. And eventually, if they accumulate more rights, it could be said that they are the primary owner of the book. And where this comes into socialism is to do with the state and society. And again, I'm going to use state and government interchangeably. So going back to the example of Ireland, there's 4 million plus people in Ireland. If we want to build a bus stop in Glencullumkill, do we canvass every 4 million plus people in Ireland? Do we send someone to all their doors and ask them, do they think this bus stop should be built, where it should be built, how much should be spent in it, and how many buses we should run a day to this bus stop? And we don't. It's incredibly impractical. You wouldn't get all 4 million plus people to agree on anything. So what happens is the human nature takes over. Humans are naturally hierarchical. So we'll naturally have a hierarchy of leaders who will make many of these decisions on our part. So what happens then is that the definition of society owning goods actually ends up as the government owning and controlling the production of goods, because the government, who direct the production, who decide where this bus stop is to be built, they actually have the rights over the resources and how they're going to be used. Because the alternative of letting everyone have an input is impossible. So you actually end up with the government effectively owning and controlling the means of production and the production of goods, which is why the two definitions are not contradictory. Now, I do have a quick aside here. As I've been talking here about socialism, this is what we could call state socialism. This is when a nation state or a country has socialism for everyone inside. There have been communes throughout history. So the Rallaghine Commune in County Clare. Robert Owens, the British industrialist, started a commune in the United States. The Pilgrims, when they landed at Plymouth Rock, began as a commune, owning everything in common and sharing goods. But these were all what you could call a voluntary socialism. Nobody was forced to join these communes out of their free will. I still think they're wrong. They're still socialists. They don't respect private property. But they're a lesser evil because no one's forced to join them. With state socialism, you don't have a choice. If 51% of the people in this country vote to be socialist, the other 49%, their input isn't relevant. Now, going into a little bit of a history of socialism. So the most important place to start is likely with Marx. Marx defined himself as a communist and not a socialist. But nonetheless, he shared many principles with socialists, and most socialists and communists advocate for change in the same way. So Marx and Engels, when they wrote the Communist Manifesto, argued for revolution. They had a teleological view of history, that we started off as agrarian stone gatherers, we've morphed into feudal societies, into mercantilism, into capitalism, into socialism, and then into communism. So Marx still believed in socialism, but for him it was just the penultimate step on the road to communism. Marx and Engels advocated for revolution. As far as they were concerned, the capitalist society of their time had to be violently overthrown to allow the socialist society to follow in its path. So obviously that's extremely problematic there, because they are deciding themselves that they have authority rather than the legitimate state. And they're deciding the direction in which society should move. They did support many socialist policies, as I said, even though they would disagree with socialists on some principles and didn't consider themselves socialist. So to address revolutionary socialism, most socialists are revolutionaries. If you look at any of the socialist parties in Ireland, most of them are revolutionary to some degree or other. Sinn Féin aren't, but it's debatable as to how socialist Sinn Féin is. Most other socialist parties don't like Sinn Féin. I personally don't think they're really socialist. They're just opportunists.
They will morph into socialism.
Yeah. They would, but they don't practice socialism as a belief. So other parties, like People Before Profit, consider Sinn Féin to not be a socialist party, because Sinn Féin will happily support industry and privatisation if it benefits them in getting into power. So they are socialist to a degree, but they don't believe in socialism as a cause. Yeah. They'll just say whatever it takes to get into power. So they're opportunistic nationalists, really. So most socialists are revolutionary, and a good example from history is that of the Bolsheviks. So the Bolsheviks in Russia, again, because they drew on Marx, they wanted to be communist. But that meant society had to become socialist, and then from socialism it would turn into communism. And to get to socialism, they needed violent revolution. And the Bolsheviks considered themselves a vanguard of socialism. As far as they were concerned, the working class for whom the revolution was being performed couldn't be trusted to actually carry out the revolution themselves. The Bolsheviks would perform the revolution on behalf of the workers, because if left to their own devices, the workers would merely seek better wages and better working conditions. So you can already see a degree of narcissism in the socialists in the way that they consider how they operate, and that they are working to the betterment of society without actually asking the rest of society what they think of it. So these sort of revolutionary societies obviously led to the USSR, and there have been similar incidents in North Korea, China, French Indochina, so Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and other societies throughout the world. They're an example of revolutionary socialism, which tends to be extremely violent, leads to great political instability and huge suffering, human suffering for those involved. Other socialists, on the other hand, are somewhat more patient and subversive. And the best example of this would be the Fabian socialists in Britain. So the Fabian socialists were a society that they were set up to bring about socialism by slowly undermining and subverting the principles of the time. So in Britain, that was of a democratic and capitalist society. By necessity, they expected their work would take much longer. So the Bolsheviks turned Russia into a socialist country within a few years. The Fabians expected their work to take decades, but that it would last longer because it would be more concrete. They would insert socialism a little bit at a time and cement it into society, so it would be much harder to remove later. A practical example of their work coming to fruition would be the United Kingdom post-Second World War, when the United Kingdom became a socialist country. So under the Labour government that was voted in 1945, transport was nationalised, steel production was nationalised, energy was nationalised, so all the coal and oil production, or what little oil Britain had, along with shipyards, the farms were not nationalised. However, a Ministry of Food was set up, and this Ministry of Food dictated what farmers could plant, how much the Ministry of Food would pay for their food, and how much that food could be sold for at a later date. So going back to the principle of ownership, although officially they didn't own the farms, by controlling all the work that was done and all the prices that were set, the Ministry of Food de facto, if not de jure, controlled and owned agriculture. So this is an example of Fabian socialism, and it likely came about as a result of the Second World War, when the government under Winston Churchill nationalised the British economy for the purposes of war, which led to a Fabian effect that people became accustomed to have the government having huge control over society, so that when the Labour government was voted in, it seemed natural for people to continue with a socialist society. Now, we'll go into some of the Catholic objections against socialism, and the most pertinent objections, I believe, come from the principles, the natural law principles of solidarity and subsidiarity. So to address these, I'll start with solidarity. When we're dealing with solidarity, human society, again, say in Ireland, our 4.5 million people, can be thought of as a body or an organism. So like the human body, we have hands to hold things, we have feet to walk, a heart to pump blood around our body. So the body has different parts, and each of these parts have a different function, and the body can only survive if all these parts are working in unison, not for themselves, but for the sake of the body as a whole. And society is like this. We have bin men and doctors and priests and police and engineers and bankers, and they're all working for society as a whole. And the reason we object to socialism is because socialism brings about the struggle of the working class. It places a divide between labour on one side and capital on the other, and maintains that capital is entirely evil, and that because of their oppression, labour is entirely good, and that labour should destroy capital, and labour will take over society. And this is opposed to solidarity because industry, particularly in a society like we live today, relies on both labour to provide work and capital to provide knowledge and resources to produce everything we have around us.
Now, what do you mean by capital?
Okay, I'm going with the free market definition of capital, which is money, resources, so that would be machinery, the ownership of land on which to build a factory, knowledge, which is normally referred to as human capital, so engineers or doctors have specific knowledge in them that has to be accumulated over time. It's rare and it takes a lot of effort to accumulate, so it's considered capital. So that capital then is knowledge, money and resources, without which work on its own can't do anything. And even when you work for yourself, if you have a hobby, you're actually providing both the labour and the capital. So labour and capital always have to work in unison.
When you're talking about labour and capital being basically a war, like that idea, like it's Marxist, and Marx based everything on that.
Yes.
But surely it is possible to have a socialist system without that. Like you don't need
it
to have
socialism. Theoretically, be possible. Most socialists don't believe so. Most socialists see the working class opposed to capital, or what Marx called it, the bourgeoisie. It's theoretically possible in an idea, but from my understanding of socialism, I don't think it'll work. Socialism eventually has to break down into class struggle, because a lot of it is based on dissatisfaction with present conditions. And as humans, we normally look for scapegoats then. So there has to end up a class struggle in socialism, even if you don't want it to happen in the first place. It's a natural consequence of socialism.
You look at, like, basic socialism, governments only controlling the different. Surely that is possible without any class struggle?
I would say no. Because in order for the government to control the means of production, it has to take the means of production from others. The best way to do this, and as we've seen with the COVID-19 pandemic, is to create a class of people that can be hated for the sake of the government. So when the vaccines were produced, as we saw here, the government started campaigns against the so-called anti-vaxxers. They created a group that could be easily targeted and made the scapegoats, so that people would notice what the government was doing. And that ends up again with a class struggle. We have a larger portion of society turning on a smaller portion of society. That has to happen in socialism, because the government cannot ask, it can ask industry to voluntarily give up their industry, but most industrialists will likely politely decline. They don't want to do it. So the next best thing is government can step in by itself. And the easiest way for government to do that, and the way it almost always turns to, is to turn the population against itself. So that those who don't own businesses or shops or industry are told, oh, look at these shop owners here. They're really terrible people. You know, it'd be great if they were out and you guys controlled the shops. And this is what happened in the Soviet Union with dekulakization. So the kulaks, after the peasants were emancipated in Imperial Russia, you ended up with a split. Some of the more industrious and intelligent peasants went on to become very modest landholders. And by kulaks, it meant they owned a couple of animals, they had a small house, they could grow some crops. There was about 1 million or so kulak families, roughly. My numbers may be off slightly, but it'll serve for this demonstration. When the Soviets took over, initially under Lenin and then later under Stalin, again, to get the people on their side, they told many of the poorer labourers who maybe worked for the kulaks that the kulaks were stealing their labour, and the people turned on the kulaks. So you had a mix of lynchings by ordinary people, and the state itself then deported hundreds of thousands of kulaks to Siberia and the gulags. And that has to happen, because in order for socialism to come about, the state has to violently remove people from their industry and their businesses and their farms, because most people won't voluntarily give it up of themselves, because the instinct for private property is part of human nature.
But as you said yourself, that's maybe the best way, but not,
yeah, but
not,
I mean, I think
the only way.
I think the question is it's completely theoretical. You're always going to have classes in society, and that's how they disrupt society.
Because they play on tribalism. So humans have an instinct for a tribe. So because we form into classes and hierarchies, we naturally feel an affinity for those closest to us. So working class people will naturally feel closer to working class people and more against the business class or the monarchy or the aristocracy. So it's very easy for government to play on that and get people to turn on each other.
When the kulaks were like deported or slaughtered, and basically the peasants, there was mass starvation and a famine broke out. Would that not, I suppose maybe people are more easily brainwashed than I'm giving them credit for, would that not have immediately given them a bit of a wake-up call to say that we're not really opposed to you know, labour as such? Not labour, but, you know, the whole lie that they've been sold ultimately, ipso facto, created starvation for themselves. So they shot themselves in the
They did, and it might have done. And under Lenin, it briefly did. So Lenin in the 1920s came up with what he called the new economic policy, where he allowed for a reprivatization of some businesses in the USSR, because the USSR's economy was failing. Now, Lenin obviously died and Stalin took over. So you have the influence of Stalin's, I suppose you could say, warlord tendencies. Stalin didn't care for people, so he didn't care that people starved.
Not at all, no.
And it's often very easy to manipulate things and say, yes, the starvation occurred, but you could blame the kulaks because they destroyed all the crops before they were carted off. For...
Which they did.
The
or...
sorry, we want to finish this by 5 past, so just no more questions, okay?
Okay.
If we need to, we can continue later if you have
yeah,
more
information.
Absolutely. That's well researched.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So I just want you to be able to finish it. So.
Well, I would rather finish it here then, which will leave enough for me to continue it later if that's amenable to people.
If you need to stop in the middle, we can come back to it.
Yeah, because I need to finish, because I'm into the sort of the second half, which is the
okay.
moral and practical
that's
objections
fine.
To
okay.
socialism.
We'll
so.
Leave it there and then we'll come back. Thanks.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank
sure.
you.
Thank you.
Thank you.